Coming up next on Penguin Radio, Father Paul Gabor from the Vatican Observatory answers the question, are we alone in the universe? We'll have it for you in its entirety. Coming up next on Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu. And approaching the lectern now is Dominican's Provost, Stephen Weisler. And we'll have his opening remarks, followed by Father Paul Gabor from the Vatican Observatory.
I'm Steve Weisler. I'm the Provost at Dominican University of California, and I want to welcome you to tonight's lecture. It's my honor and my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, about whom I will say a few words before turning the microphone over to him. Father Paul Gabor was born in Slovakia and studied particle physics at Charles University Prague, Czech Republic, from 1988 to 1995. His work was primarily instrumental, participating in the development of the ATLAS detector for the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland. He entered the Society of Jesus in 1995, did his two-year novitiate in the Czech Republic, and then 2 years of philosophy studies in Krakow, Poland. After this, he taught philosophy for a year in the Czech Republic, went on to study theology in Paris, France. He was ordained to the priesthood in 2004. I'm still not done. Stick with me here. This is quite impressive. After ordination, he earned a PhD in astrophysics in 2009 in Paris. Father Gabor is interested in tests of achromatic phase shifters, stabilization through optical path dithering, wavefront filtering with single mode fibers, polarization and other issues regarding the implementation of nulling interferometry, techniques and instrumentation that can be used to discover planets orbiting other stars. Did you get all that? Excellent. Father Gabor joined the Vatican Observatory in September 2010 and was assigned to the Vatican Observatory Research Group in Tucson. He became its vice director in September 2012. He's here tonight to speak to us on the topic of Are We Alone in the Universe? Please join me in welcoming Father Gabor.
Thank you. Thank you for this wonderful introduction. I've completely forgotten what I was really interested in, right? The achromatic phase shifters. But tonight we'll talk about what these achromatic phase shifters are used for, and I need to introduce that topic in a slightly broader context of the extraterrestrial life debate. Let me start with this New Yorker cartoon from May 1950. New Yorker got to Los Alamos usually with a slight delay, and what happened was that sometime in July, perhaps, 1950, Enrico Fermi and other people, looking at this nice explanation of why there are so few dustbins in New York, are being abducted by aliens, as you can see, asked themselves whether this was a plausible explanation. I mean, these are all geeks, you know, so they really end up taking certain things seriously that you're not supposed to take seriously. So these are the people who were having lunch that day, a couple of Nobel Prize winners in there, and Enrico Fermi was at his second course, I think, when the debate was already at something completely different, and he said, all of a sudden, where is everybody? And it goes to show that the other people at the table understood and knew him quite well, because they realized that what he meant was how many advanced communicating extraterrestrial civilizations are there in the galaxy. And that he actually calculated the number to be about 1 million while he was eating the first course, right? Now, if you have 1 million civilizations just in our own galaxy, okay, the question is, where are they? Why haven't we actually interacted with them? Where is everybody? Now, the guy at the next table said, well, they're already here and they call themselves Hungarian. And that was the first solution to the Fermi paradox, historically proposed, right? So this is the Fermi paradox, where is everybody? And the first answer. There is a nice book that came out about 8 years ago by Stephen Webb that catalogs about 50 of possible theories and answers to the Fermi paradox. I don't want to go through them all, but basically what I want to show you in this talk is, number one, that this question is a very old one. It doesn't start with New York in 1950. And second, I would like to show you what science does today to try and estimate how many they are, I mean, how many civilizations there are, and perhaps find them. At least find microbes. Microbes are easier to find, surprisingly enough, with astronomical means than alien civilizations. At least so we think. The question really is a very old one. Since we are at the Dominican University, let me quote an illustrious Dominican, St. Albertus Magnus, who in the 13th century already says that do there exist many worlds, or is there but a single world? This is one of the most noble and exalted questions in the study of nature. Of course, he goes on to answer that there is only one world. And I want to explain to you why he would answer that way. So, first, let me say that the question was probably first asked by this gentleman here in the 6th century BC. And he again probably said, no, there is only one world, but he at least asked the question. People who lived slightly later than this guy, the first atomists, were proponents of the hypothesis that really there are many worlds, that there is an infinity of worlds, in fact. And this theory was then taken up by one of the most popular schools of philosophy of antiquity, the Epicurean school. So it was a very well-known position. Now, what I need to explain is what they meant by worlds. Today, when we talk about worlds, we mean planets, generally speaking. We mean these globular things that have a nice surface, and you have perhaps an ocean or dry land and other structures that can support life. Well, the antiquity meant a completely different thing by worlds and a multiplicity of worlds. What they meant was that you had an earth in the middle, you had the sun, the moon, and the planets revolving around it, and you had a sphere of fixed stars. And that was a world, and you had many worlds like this, okay? So that was essentially what they meant by many worlds. Today, the idea which is closest to this would be a multiverse theory. Basically, you have many universes rather than many planets that are inhabited. You have many universes that are essentially analogous in their structure and also therefore in their properties, and so including their ability to sustain life. The big jump forward in this debate came with a very interesting thinker of the late Middle Ages, Nicholas of Cusa. This gentleman came up with an idea that, in fact, as I quote here, the earth is a celestial body. Now, this was a big shift in thought. The earth is not a different thing from, let's say, the sun or the moon. It is not fundamentally different. It is just one other heavenly body of a similar nature as these other heavenly bodies. Now, this type of a thing is rather surprising, because the whole mindset was that the earth was made of completely different elements than the heavens are. And Nicholas of Cusa came to this conclusion in a way that is rather convoluted, and I would be quite unable to explain it to you. Number one, because I don't understand it myself properly, in spite of the fact that I read a couple of his books. And second, because it is rather difficult. And he has tried to explain it to other people in his day, in the 15th century, without much success. Anyway, what he came up with are other conclusions that are quite surprising. So once you have this idea that the earth is in fact one of the heavenly bodies, you have certain other things that go with it. For instance, that since the earth is a heavenly body, and we know that the earth is inhabited, then other heavenly bodies have to be inhabited too. Okay? So you have inhabitants on the sun, you have inhabitants on the moon, quite naturally you have inhabitants anywhere you like. Okay? So this is Nicholas of Cusa. In fact, what I find particularly interesting about Nicholas of Cusa is that, according to him, there is absolutely no reason to think that these inhabitants of other heavenly bodies are similar to us in character, moral character, in physical properties, in anything at all. They can be completely and utterly different, including, and this is perhaps interesting for theology, if you like, including the way they relate to God. So the inhabitants of the sun, for instance, if there are any inhabitants of the sun, would be so full of godly light that they have no need of salvation because of their sins. Okay? They would be more akin to angels in that respect. What happened a little later, a couple of centuries in fact later, was that some of these ideas of Nicholas of Cusa were taken up by Giordano Bruno, and as you know, the canonical history of science claims that Giordano Bruno is the first person to start thinking about in basically alien civilizations. It's not true. Basically, by omitting Nicholas of Cusa, you manage to produce a very nice story that somehow creates the idea that, in fact, as soon as you start talking about aliens, the church would want to burn you alive at the stake, which is not what happened. Certainly not what happened to Nicholas of Cusa. In any case, Giordano Bruno was a thinker who did push the idea a little forward by combining it with the idea that stars are like the sun, in the sense that there are planets orbiting them. Okay, Nicholas of Cusa basically didn't think that far. He didn't think about the nature of the fixed stars as they were perceived at the time. He just assumed that the number of bodies we see with the naked eye in the sky is basically the full repertory of bodies that exist in the universe. But Bruno went a little further, and he said, well, these stars are like the sun, and therefore they have planets around them. So that was really a novel idea. Now, the thing is that Bruno's idea basically was unknown to René Descartes, or Cartesius, a French philosopher who lived basically just a generation, just two generations after Giordano Bruno, and it was through Cartesian thought that this idea became popular. So let me go back a little bit to explain why our friend St. Albert Magnus thought that it was completely absurd that there would be more than one world. It has to do with the legacy of antiquity. The philosophy in antiquity was not really an academic discipline as we think of it today. It was more to do with training of men, essentially. There were some female philosophers, but those were the exceptions to the rule, in living well. So the goal was not to learn about the world in philosophy, but to acquire an art of living. In other words, acquire practical wisdom that was expressed, perhaps, through a vision of the world, through a certain cosmology, but that was not necessarily the main point of the exercise. So the question was not primarily, what is the world like? But the question was, how am I supposed to achieve happiness? How am I supposed to achieve my goals in life? And in order to do that, people were taught to meditate, perhaps. They were taught to do things like examine their conscience and so on. And this has nothing to do with religion. This was done in schools of philosophy. Now, this type of philosophy, a philosophy that is really oriented towards a wisdom of living, is tied with the idea of how the world looks in an intimate way. So the Epicureans, for instance, who believed that to attain it, that you can't really achieve happiness, what you can do is you can minimize your suffering. And if you do it in a sustainable way, that's the best you can do. Minimize your suffering. There are no higher goals in life. Essentially, you're just trying to survive somehow until you die, which is sort of absurd, but that's the absurdity of existence as such. It's a very down-to-earth, very, how shall I put it, atheistic, if you like, philosophy. This is a sort of a philosophy that many people subscribe to without really putting it under the label of Epicureanism today. The philosophy, of course, ties in extremely well with the idea that there are many worlds that are just as absurd as ours, just as without any deeper meaning or significance. And they provide this eternal dance of particles in an empty space. On the antipodes of this type of thinking, there is a tradition of, let's say, Socrates and the schools that stem from him. So in those schools, what you have is an idea that the world makes sense. On a very deep level, it is one. And that this oneness of the world means that the world can be explained, that the world is something that you can relate to in a positive way, because the world makes sense, you make sense, or the other way around perhaps, but in any case it's interconnected. And the world being fundamentally one is a big part of this. If the world is fundamentally one, it means that your goal in life is to be one with this oneness of the world, to achieve a certain level of communion with the universe. And again, it won't make sense if the universe were multiple fundamentally, because you can't be dispersed in achieving this goal of your own wholeness, of your own perfection, if you like. The perfection is in being one. Now you see the problem. So a fragmented multiple world of the atomists and the Epicureans is something that the tradition of Plato and Aristotle rejected entirely as something that can't possibly lead people to a meaningful life. Okay? And that is the reason, that is the fundamental reason why this idea that there would be many worlds was so abhorrent to philosophers, and especially to the philosophers of the Middle Ages who subscribed to the great tradition of Plato and Aristotle. Of course, some of the philosophers were in fact too enthusiastic about Aristotle in particular. So in the 13th century, the church tried to moderate the debate a little bit because these philosophers said that essentially, like Aristotle, human reason can achieve and penetrate things that are fundamentally unattainable. And this ambition of the philosophers of the time needed a little bit of a cold shower. So what happened was that in 1277, there were 219 Aristotelian propositions that the church condemned. And one of them, number 34, that was condemned, is that the first cause, in other words, God, could not create many worlds. So, in fact, the church, since 1277, quite formally teaches that there can be many worlds. Okay. The reasons why this condemnation came about is simply because of the method at which this proposition was reached by the teachers of philosophy in Paris, basically. But the position of the church in this was very simply that you should not limit divine freedom on the basis of philosophical speculation. So let's get back to our three types of cosmic pluralism. So remember that, you know, in antiquity there were many worlds, many globes with planets around them and fixed stars encompassing the whole. And you had an infinity of those. That was the Epicurean style of cosmic pluralism. Then you had the second style with Nicholas of Cusa. And finally, basically, an idea that we have today that stars are, so Nicholas of Cusa says that the Earth is a heavenly body, and then Bruno says that the sun is like the stars, or rather the other way around. Stars are like the sun in the sense that they've got planets around them. Let me just mention Nicholas of Cusa a little more, because he's so underrepresented in histories of science. He's not really a scientist. He was basically a mathematician and philosopher. He's definitely not a scientist in the modern sense of the word. On the other hand, nobody before Newton really was. It was very difficult to identify modern scientists before that. So Nicholas of Cusa wrote this book in 1440, where he says that the Earth is not at the center of the universe. The universe could be infinite. Earth is of the same nature as the stars, the heavenly bodies, that is to say. There is no perfection in the physical universe. He was a Platonist. And therefore, celestial spheres cannot be perfectly spherical, for instance. He says that the stars were habitable, heavenly bodies, and that there were many non-human extraterrestrial beings inhabiting these heavenly bodies. Now, it did not hurt his career in the church at all. He published the book in 1440, and he was made a cardinal in 1448. Okay. So this guy just doesn't fit in with the idea that if you said things like this, it automatically, in the Middle Ages, it automatically guaranteed that you would be, well, at least having some problems with the Inquisition. The book that really popularized the idea of planets orbiting other stars than the sun is, in fact, this book by a gentleman, De Fontenelle, who essentially was a philosopher, thinker perhaps rather, writer mainly, of the Cartesian persuasion. So in 1686 he published this book, which became extremely well read at the time. The idea that, you know, there are many worlds. So this is a treatise on the plurality of worlds. What does science do today to answer this question? Well, there are several different approaches. First is SETI. We're in California, the home of SETI, right? SETI stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and as the name implies, the idea is to look for signals that a technologically advanced civilization would emit, either in a planned way or simply because it's a byproduct of some other activity. And basically what you do is you build radio telescopes and you look for these signals. SETI Institute has been doing that since 1960, and they haven't really found anything. That doesn't mean that there is nothing there, it just means that it's very difficult to find. So they keep trying to get some funding and get the thing running, keep the thing running. Another approach is what biologists and chemists try to do. They try to reproduce the emergence of life from non-living materials, substances. And this is a project that goes back at least to the 1950s, and so far hasn't really reached any significant results. Of course, the first experiments by Miller and Urey in 1953 were quite a success, and they gave quite an impetus to this field. But essentially, since then, the research has been frustrated by a series of essentially failures. So we still don't know how life on Earth originated, and we can't even begin to try and reproduce it in a laboratory. We can tinker with the life that exists, right? We can make microbes do things that we essentially designed them for, but those are microbes that are already alive. An approach that finally gets us a little closer to my field, that is astronomy, is the exploration of the solar system. Now, as you know, the prime suspect for a long time has been Mars, and this is Percival Lowell, who built a big telescope in Flagstaff in Arizona to look for surface features on Mars that would indicate the presence of a technologically advanced civilization there. This is an approach that has been superseded by other approaches, mainly sending probes to different parts of the solar system. And these probes can in situ measure things and bring samples back to Earth, although that hasn't really been done properly yet, apart from the moon. But the question is, where do you want to look, and what do you want to be looking for? Okay, so you've got $10 billion to spend, you sent a probe somewhere, well, what do you want to look for, right? So one of the things that people have tried is to see what possible habitats there can be. And since most heavenly bodies in the solar system, other planets, moons of planets, asteroids and so on, tend to be quite hostile environments, we've started looking at hostile environments on Earth to see whether Earth life can exist there. And this is the research into what is called extremophiles, that is microorganisms, microbes, that live in places where you and I would definitely not want to go for a vacation, like in deep sea vents, or under the ice of Antarctica. In all those places, you can find microbes. So what does that mean? It means that perhaps you could find microbes of some sort, maybe not on the surface of Venus, where the temperatures and pressures are really quite unpleasant and definitely very uncomfortable, but maybe somewhere in the atmosphere of Venus, in the clouds of Venus, or more likely somewhere under the surface of Mars, or even, because as you know, we have fairly good evidence that there was a period in the early history of Mars where there was a significant amount of water on the surface, creating these geological features that are clearly a product of water flow. So we've been looking for these microbes that might be hidden under the surface, or possibly just some traces of microbes that have lived at some earlier geological era in the history of Mars. There is another body in the solar system with a fully developed atmosphere. So I'd like to ask you to tell me which one it is. So this is the Earth, obviously. This is what? That's Venus, right? So what is this? I mean, all right, this is what? That's Mars, right? So what is the fourth one? No. I'm asking about a body that has a fully developed atmosphere. No. It's a moon, that's true, of a giant planet. That's Titan, that's correct, yes. It's the largest moon of Saturn, and it has a fully developed atmosphere. It's rather strange because these moons don't tend to have atmospheres, but this one does. This is Titan. You can see a part of the rings of Saturn. This is one of the smaller moons of Saturn. I can't remember which one, maybe Enceladus. And this thing here is Titan. And as you can see, this is not because the picture is out of focus. This is simply because there is a fuzzy edge to Titan because of the atmosphere. So Titan has an atmosphere, and nearly 10 years ago, a probe managed to descend into that atmosphere and take some pictures of the surface. So we know that there are these bodies of liquid on the surface of Titan. There are, in fact, lakes of methane and ethane, because Titan is so cold that basically the propane gas you get in the bottles, and which is under high pressure, because on Earth you need to have it under high pressure, otherwise it would be gaseous. On Titan it is so cold that it is gaseous, that it is liquid under normal circumstances, and in fact methane itself is liquid. Oops, pushed the wrong button. So you end up having these bodies of liquid methane and ethane, and it is possible, perhaps, that there is life there. Now, if there is life, it would be really completely different from terrestrial life, simply because of the chemistry. These are non-polar solvents, and therefore their properties are very different to water in many ways, and if there is life, it would very likely be based on something very different on a very fundamental level. So if we do find life on Titan, it would be a great way of saying, yes, there are two instances, two examples of life that emerged independently of each other within one solar system. So it's a great proposition. Of course, it's a very ambitious project to send another probe there, a probe that would be able to detect this very exotic life, because we don't really know what to look for in the first place. What we would know what to look for, perhaps, a little more, would be to find life in the oceans under the thick crust of ice on Jupiter's moon Europa. So that's another possibility. And actually, there is a space mission that will go and explore Jupiter's moons in the next 10 years or so. So we shall perhaps learn something more about Europa then. The field that I find personally most intriguing, and I invest most of my energies to, is the field of exoplanets. As you know, we've actually started discovering planets orbiting other stars than our own sun. About 1995, the first discovery was made. It was a planet that essentially is bigger than our own Jupiter and is very close to its parent star. That's why it's called a hot Jupiter. Many planets of that category were found. The reason they were found is very simple. It is an observational bias. It is easier to find bigger planets orbiting close to their parent star than finding smaller planets orbiting far from the star. So that's why we know about many hot Jupiters. And over the years, there were certain new types of planets that were discovered. Planets that we didn't even suspect existed, like these hot Jupiters, for instance. If somebody claimed that we would find hundreds of stars with planets that are so close to the star that essentially they are nearly touching the surface, so to speak, nobody would have believed that in 1994. In 1995, a first planet like that was found. Okay. And so this is a planet with a large mass orbiting its parent star at an eccentric orbit, nearly as eccentric as some comets. So really an elongated ellipse. How did that happen? Okay, nobody really knows, and it's very difficult to explain from the point of view of celestial mechanics. It's even worse with certain other systems where you find multiple large planets, very large planets. You see, how did these arise? Was it because there was just so much material orbiting that star when it was being formed out of a gaseous nebula? We don't really know. And the mechanisms behind the existence of some of these rather exotic systems are unknown. In 1999, the first planet was discovered with a different method. This time, it was a planet that, from our point of view, obscures a little bit of the star's light. So from time to time, if you observe the star, okay, you have a certain level of brightness, and for days, months, the level of brightness doesn't change. And then for a few hours, the star dims a little bit. So if you are patient enough and keep watching the star all the time, you'll find that sometimes its brightness goes down a little bit, let's say by 0.1%, and you notice that dip, you note when it happened, and then you watch for another one. And if another one comes, and another one, and another one, and it's always in the same interval, then you can deduce, aha, that is a planet. Okay? So it's a very tedious process, but it can be done. And the other methods, in fact, the planets that I showed you before, the planets that were discovered between 1995 and 1999, were mostly discovered because stars wobble in the sky if they are orbited by planets. As you can see, a planet, in fact, exerts a certain force upon the star. It's not just that the star is attracting the planet. It's a mutual attraction. It's just that the planet obviously moves much faster, and it's a much lighter body. So the motion of the star is much smaller. In fact, this picture here exaggerates things quite a bit. Our own star, the sun, moves a little bit because of the motion of Jupiter around it. and anyway, so once you know that the star moves, you can actually measure the speed of that motion using a method that you probably know about. Doppler, the Doppler effect. There is a red shift and a blue shift in the spectrum of the star, depending on whether it is coming closer to us or receding from us. So, in any case, this method of radial velocities has been used extensively since 95, and since 99 we've also had this method of exoplanetary transits. The first cool Jupiter was discovered in 2002. It's basically orbiting at about the same distance of its parent star as our own Jupiter. So the temperature on its surface is comparable to that of our Jupiter. So that really is cool. And then planets that were a little smaller than that were found in 2004. Planets the size of Neptune, or the class of Neptune. Jupiter is about 310 times more massive than the Sun, than the Earth. Okay. Neptune is about 17 times more massive than the Earth. And these planets that were found around the star Mu of the constellation Ara were basically of that class, Neptune-sized. In 2005, a first planet that was even smaller than that was found, a planet that was dubbed a super-Earth. Super-Earth in the sense that the mass was in that mass range of less than 10 times the mass of the Earth. But since we don't really know what the diameter of that planet is, and we're unlikely to know that because it's very difficult to find this particular type of a property at a distance. So we don't know the diameter of that planet, and therefore we can't really say what its composition might be. We just know the mass, because we know the force it exerts on its parent star, and that is due to its mass. So since we don't know the diameter, we don't know the density, and therefore we can't deduce the composition. But we still call them super-Earths, planets like this. Just perhaps a good PR exercise, but it's not really saying much. In 2007, the first super-Earth was discovered in the habitable zone of its parent star. The habitable zone is a range of distances from the parent star that allows for the presence of liquid water on the surface of the planet in a sustained fashion. So in the case of the solar system, in fact, the Earth obviously is in the habitable zone. Venus is on the edge of the habitable zone, and Mars is on the other edge of the habitable zone. In the system Gliese 581, there's quite a number of planets, and the first one that was discovered in 2007 was this one, which was on the inner edge of the habitable zone. Since then, there were a couple more planets discovered in the habitable zone around that star. It's a smaller star, therefore the habitable zone is closer to it. You need to be closer to the star to get more warmth out of it, okay? Because it is a dimmer star. So in 2009, the first super-Earth where we know the diameter was discovered, and it is really a very strange planet. It's orbiting extremely close to its parent star, and it's always showing the parent star the same side. So in fact, the substellar point is always the same, and therefore extremely hot. So hot that the rock there is molten, and you have a veritable ocean of molten rock on dominating one side of the planet. The other side of the planet is extremely cold because it never gets any light from its parent star. And rocks are a very bad heat conductor. So now we've got a huge number of planets. These days we are celebrating the confirmed discovery of about 1,000 of them. And all this diversity teaches us quite a bit about our own solar system in an indirect fashion. What we learn are a few things that might be quite surprising, in fact. Certainly surprising to people who wrote textbooks about the solar system until we learned all this. So, I think I need to stop this. The planets that we've discovered teach us that they are really very different from our own solar system. They are quite often very hot. Quite often we have no idea how they could have formed on the basis of what we know from the solar system, where we've got a very good idea how it formed. At least we thought we had a very good idea how it formed. And we have found that essentially every star that can have planets does have planets. So there is a huge number of planets, and very probably even planets that are the size of the Earth out there in the universe. It's just that it's so hard to learn more about them. We know that they exist, and over the years we've learned perhaps some glimpse of their basic properties, like their mass, sometimes their bulk density, but we've never really discovered, really can't discover much more with the current means that we've got, because we never actually see the planets. There are some exceptions, like this one, Fomalhaut. You can actually see the planet, but it's a planet that's orbiting very, very far from its parent star, and that's why you can see it. And similarly, in this system, HR8799, you can also see three planets, but they are, again, very far from the parent star, and that's why you can see them. So how can you go and learn a little more about a cosmic body that is extremely far away and whose light is really outshined by the light of the parent star very, very badly? Well, you have to come up with a clever way how to distinguish which light comes from the star and which light comes from the planet. Because once you do that, once you have an idea of the properties of that light, you can deduce something about the chemical composition of the atmosphere of the planet. And once you have that, you can perhaps say, aha, well, this planet looks very strange, and the properties of its atmosphere seem to indicate that there is something happening there that we can't explain using simple chemical and physical processes. There's probably something like life on that planet. For instance, if you look at three planets of the solar system, the Earth, Venus, and Mars, you see that the atmosphere of Mars contains primarily carbon dioxide and nothing much of interest other than that. The atmosphere, and you deduce this simply by looking at the spectrum, that is to say, you say how much of which color is present in the light of that particular heavenly body. If you look at the spectrum of Venus and look which colors are underrepresented in that spectrum, you find that Venus has, again, a lot of carbon dioxide and nothing much else you can see in that spectrum. When you look at the spectrum of the Earth, you see quite a number of goodies. You see water vapor. You see, of course, carbon dioxide, but you also see this water vapor, and you see also ozone, in other words, oxygen. Now, the presence of these three species is something that cannot be explained, at least nobody has come up with a good explanation, other than simply by the presence of photosynthesizing plants and especially microbes, on this planet. It is primarily the microbes that produce this feature here, the oxygen. If you don't have a mechanism producing oxygen all the time, then you don't really have a chance of having that feature in the spectrum. It would disappear very quickly without any life. You know, oxygen is in fact quite a caustic chemical. It tends to bind itself to metals very readily. So within a few tens of thousands of years, probably, maybe a little more, all the oxygen in Earth's atmosphere would disappear and essentially become a part of rocks. So the fact that there is this spectral feature on Earth is extremely intriguing to an alien looking at the Earth. If we were looking at a planet orbiting another star and we saw a similar spectrum to the Earth, we would really be overjoyed, but it's not very obvious that we would find something like this. We would probably find something which is even more difficult to explain, something that might be very intriguing, but not necessarily an indication, a clear indication of life, because we don't really know what life is. It's another thing. We don't really know what we're looking for. In any case, the challenge is to be able to distinguish the light from the star from the light from the planet. And this is very difficult because the planet is much dimmer than the star, and it is very close to it. So, and what's more, there usually is dust that scatters light and makes things even worse. So, in fact, the situation is similar to this. Suppose you have a firefly, you want to observe it. The problem is that the firefly is flying around a lighthouse. The lighthouse is glaring at you, and the firefly is just a foot away from it. Now, this is already very difficult. I don't know whether you've seen any fireflies lately, but they are pretty dim, right? You really have to have a pretty dark spot to be able to see them. So with a lighthouse glaring at you, you can't really expect to see them at all. But the problem is even worse, because it's not just that the firefly is so close to the lighthouse and the lighthouse is so much brighter than the firefly, it's also that you are 1,000 miles away. And that is not the end of the story either. There is fog everywhere, okay? And you don't just want to know that there is a firefly, which of its own would be quite an achievement, but you want to go a little further. You want to analyze the exact shade of its underbelly, okay? So this is exactly what we're trying to do with these extrasolar planets. And believe it or not, what the provost was reading about those achromatic phase shifters, those are various, let's say, tricks with mirrors that opticians can use to make this possible. So there are several concepts of space probes that can achieve this type of a detection and analysis of light from these extrasolar planets. So, just to explain that, in fact, the planets that we do know exist in a very small region of our own galaxy. This is the region that we've explored. It's the region that is closest to us. This is our own galaxy, okay? This is maybe 100,000 light years across. And the little bubble that we've explored is maybe 1,000 light years across. You know, so it's just 1% of the diameter. In other words, we have only explored a small part of our own galaxy, and of course, there are very, very many galaxies in the universe. So, in fact, if we are alone in the universe, it would be quite a colossal waste of space. So thank you, and any questions? Can you get some water, please?